From New Hampshire Public Radio, I'm Mike Arnold with The Exchange. You don't have to go too far to conjure up a memory from people who know the history of the Boston Marathon. Simply hearing today's hot weather forecast may remind people of the marathon in 1976, when the temperatures went up to 100 degrees during the race. They jokingly called it the Run for the Hoses. The story of the hot race in 1976 is just one of many tales that are attached to the famed race. Over the past 107 years, the marathon has been the site of incredible victories and a few scandals. We're talking about the lore of the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange, and you can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Do you have any interesting tales from the Boston Marathon, or have you ever run it? Well, you can call with your stories at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Joining me today from the WBUR studios in Boston is Tom Derderian. He's a 14-time Boston Marathon finisher with a best time of 2:19, a coach for the Greater Boston Track Club, and author of two books on the Boston Marathon: Boston Marathon, the First Century of the World's Premier Running Event, and the Boston Marathon, a Century of Blood, Sweat, and Cheers. Tom Derderian, welcome to The Exchange.
Great to be here.
Well, let's start off by talking about what makes the Boston Marathon so special to people. What do you think that is, Tom Derderian?
Well, it's been around for a long time. It's a legend. It's the oldest one, and people venerate the oldest one. That's why I'm looking forward to aging, as people venerate age. It started in 1897. The only other marathon in the world before that was the Olympic Marathon, and then there was one in New York. So Boston may have been the third, and it was imitating what the ancient Greeks supposedly did when Pheidippides ran to announce victory and dropped dead.
Now, that was one of the interesting things about the beginning of the marathon. When it first started, the whole notion of someone running a marathon was not considered a healthy thing, right?
Well, in those days, the late years of the 1800s, the paradigm of a young man was to sacrifice and die for his country. I mean, this is the kind of attitude that preceded World War One, mm-hmm. when young men charged out of the trenches into machine gun fire. The essential myth was the story of Pheidippides, who sacrificed all to announce victory. He was a soldier. And this was the schoolboy myth. Every schoolboy knew about Pheidippides and how much he sacrificed. And that was the kind of model they were supposed to follow in their lives. So the marathon was this contest that was considered to be much like boxing, that a young man only had one marathon in his body. And to compete in the marathon, he did so at peril to his health. Of course, the idea of women running a marathon was unthinkable.
So the people who came to watch the marathon were basically, it was almost like going to see, the lions taking on the people in ancient Rome or something.
That's it. They were gladiators. The spectators right. lined the streets in order to watch to see if someone might die. Now, let me tell you the story of, want to hear the story of the New Hampshire runner won the Boston Marathon. This was 1909. And let me tell you about the attitude towards the marathon in 1909. In 1908, at the Olympic Marathon, an Italian, Doranto Petri, was leading the race into the Colosseum. Mm-hmm. When he stopped, he fell down, he got up, he staggered along, he fell down again, he staggered, he wobbled, and the officials couldn't stand this anymore, this guy standing up, falling down, getting up, falling down, that they helped him across the line.
Hmm.
Later, other officials disqualified him. Big controversy. Now, Petri was in the hospital day after day, and newspapers all over the world were covering the story to see if he would live or die. Would the marathoner live or die? The gold medal was awarded to an American, Hayes. Should that have happened? Big controversy. And this went on, and the marathon became very popular.
Hmm. But it was popular because you were watching to see whether they would live or die.
Yes, and then what happened was that marathons popped up all over the country, including these match marathons, two guys against each other on an indoor track running a marathon, just two guys. Now picture this. The air is full of blue smoke from the cigar-smoking bettors. They're putting their money on one guy or the other guy. Do you want to go with Petrie? Do you want to go with Hayes? Sort of a rematch. And lots of money was changing hands. I mean, this was big business. So marathons were, you know, the lottery of the day.
Wow.
And people watched like they would watch boxing. One of these guys is going to drop dead. And they were watching it in indoor arenas like they would watch boxing matches.
Hmm. So that's the world in which the Boston Marathon got its start.
And in 1909... lots more people entered the Boston Marathon than ever before. There were 184 entries. But what happened was the warm front came blowing up through the Gulf of Mexico or whatever it did, and it got to be very hot.
Mm-hmm.
All these guys were out in this what was considered a blood sport. They were going to race each other, and they were all excited. And they ran too fast.
Huh.
And one guy in the field from New Hampshire was not even anywhere near considered a favorite. His name was Henry Renault. He lived in Nashua,
mm-hmm.
and he worked in a cotton mill. His family had come down from Quebec some years before. Now, in the cotton mill, it was very hot, where he worked 12 hours a day. They didn't have any OSHA rules in those days. The air was filled with cotton dust. In order to keep the dust from igniting and exploding, the air was filled with little water spray. So it was hot and humid. So this was the atmosphere Henry Renault worked in day after day after day. Other people didn't do that. They worked outside. At 6 miles, Renault is in 53rd place in the marathon. And the lead keeps changing hands over and over again. Guys take the lead. They drop out. They stop. They fall down. They used to fall down a lot in those days. and slowly, people were stopping in front of Renault, and he kept moving up. And finally, he was in first place, and he swore that he was American for speed and French for gameness and went on to victory.
And he's the only person from New Hampshire who's ever won the Boston Marathon.
Only person from New Hampshire who's ever won the Boston Marathon, that's right.
And he won it on a day like today.
Yes. So if history is bound to repeat itself, and you believe that, this could be the day for someone from New Hampshire.
Well, we're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation. Have you ever won the Boston or run the Boston Marathon? Talk about your experience. You can also talk about your favorite Boston Marathon moment or why is it that the Boston Marathon has an appeal to you. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Tom Dedarian is here talking to me about the Boston Marathon. And why don't you tell me a little bit about how you became interested in the marathon to start off, Tom?
Well, I grew up in Milford, Mass., which is the next town from Hopkinton.
Mm-hmm.
And what you did on Patriots Day, well, my parents did, was when we went to Hopkinton to watch the marathon. So I was watching the marathon, according to my parents, when I was an infant.
Hmm.
Then I was a kid, and I would get a balloon. It was a big deal.
So when did you start running?
In 67, when I was in high school. People who have paid the entry fee to run the marathon might be interested to know that in 67, I'll take a guess at what the entry fee was in 67. It's, I think, $95, $100 now. In 67, the entry fee was nothing.
Hmm. Completely free. And how did you get into the race at that time? Did you have to qualify?
You only had to be over 18. And you just showed up. So I showed up. I got a ride from my friends and showed up in Hopkinton and had a medical exam. Every runner still in those days had to be examined by a doctor. This came about after the 1909 race.
Mm-hmm.
So you would have to lift your shirt up and a doctor would listen to your heart to make sure you had one. that would ensure that the marathon was safe for you.
So even at that time, they thought that the marathon was not a safe thing for people.
And many runners who had pulse irregularities, arrhythmias, were rejected. One year, three guys were told they couldn't run. They ran anyway and finished in the top 10. Because, you know, marathon is a stubborn bunch anyway. They're not going to listen to anyone. If they say don't run, they're going to run even more.
Mm-hmm. Now, So that is something that's happened recently, the whole notion of the marathon being bad for a person. It wasn't just something that happened in the early days. It was something that as recently as 1967, people were concerned about the impact that a marathon could have on people.
It began to change, I think, in the 50s when our president, Eisenhower, was talking about golfing and being outside and exercising.
Mm-hmm.
It was Dr. Paul Dudley White talked about how exercise was important to prevent heart disease.
Mm-hmm.
This is when the attitude came about. Then President Kennedy's physical fitness program that got a lot of people thinking that running was good for you.
Right.
And no longer just the thing that young men did at peril.
Right.
To prove how tough they are, it was a good thing for people to do as they got older.
Right.
Not just a couple of dried up old weirdo marathoner guys. It was something okay for normal people to do. So people began to run, and men after college continued to train, and that's when the marathon boom of the 70s came about. I call that the second marathon boom. The first one was in 1909 or so.
And that was when marathons were sort of like boxing matches, sort of endurance tests for people.
Yeah, and there was a boom through then. It decreased during the First World War, built up through the 20s, crashed during the Depression along with everything else. Participation was low during World War II. Then it was still fairly low and fairly small, and began to zoom upward in 69. That's when the number of entrants reached over 1,000, 69. Then it increased steadily. Then problems occurred in the early 80s when the Boston Marathon remained an amateur event. Other marathons in the world paid prize money, mm-hmm. but Boston refused to pay prize money, thinking that the prestige of the Boston Marathon was enough to attract top runners. But the top runners went for the money and went to other races. So Boston suddenly, in a couple of years, became a local road race. And the winning times dropped off very rapidly. So third, fourth, fifth places were places that wouldn't have been in the top 20 a few years earlier.
Hmm. Very interesting. So it's this kind of... Go ahead.
In the mid-80s.
Mm-hmm.
86 is when John Hancock came in with lots of money for prize money. Then runners from all over the world came back to Boston in a manner orchestrated by John Hancock. They invited particular athletes in order to create a field. And since then, the only athletes to win the Boston Marathon, men and women, were athletes invited by Hancock.
Mm-hmm.
So they were part of the picked field. No one has come out of nowhere like Henry Renault came out of nowhere to win. That just doesn't happen anymore.
So it has changed quite a bit. We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Have you ever run the Boston Marathon? You can talk about your experience. What was your favorite Boston Marathon moment? Why is it that the Boston Marathon has an appeal that supersedes all other marathon events for you? And have you ever watched the Boston Marathon firsthand and have interesting stories from that experience? Call in and join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Now, Tom Dedarian, do you think it's important for people to understand the history of the Boston Marathon in order to fully appreciate it?
Well, I certainly think so. I wrote this 600-something page book about it. And it certainly was a revelation to me. When I was a hotshot runner kid, I looked at the results from the past Boston Marathons and sort of wrote it off, said, oh, I could have beat these guys. I would have won that one. I would have won that one. I would have won that one without an appreciation for the fact that had I been a young man in 1910, I would not have had the same life. I would have had some job on a farm, I suppose, loading a wagon, shoveling coal. Life was different. So as I researched this book, I saw that the marathon reflected the attitude of the world. and the economics of the world. So I use the marathon as a mirror to the changing history of the last century. You know, for example, I was surprised to find a man who won the Boston Marathon during World War I, the next year was in France, was sprinting out of the trenches into German machine gun fire, and was actually running while he was killed. Hmm. And wasn't able to come back to defend his title. That was Jimmy Duffy from Canada.
Another thing you learned about in your research about the Boston Marathon was how women played a role in the marathon. That first marathon that you talked about in 1967, it was the first time that a woman ran with a number on her, although she was not really allowed to be in that, correct?
Well, I was looking through all the old newspaper reports, spending a lot of time in the Boston Public Library, deep, dark down in the dungeon where the microfilm was kept, and I wanted to find that maybe in the 20s there were some women clamoring to run the Boston Marathon. No, in the 20s, that's when Amelia Earhart flew her airplane across the Atlantic.
Mm-hmm.
Gertrude Ederle swam the English Channel. I mean, the 20s, when women got the vote, there was a lot of agitation for women to do things. And women were doing these courageous, so-called manly things. So I thought there would be something in the newspapers, some woman who wanted to run Boston in the 20s or the 30s or the 40s. I remember in the 40s, women were working men's jobs during the war, you know, Rosie the Riveter. Still, no women until 66, when Roberta Gibb...
Mm-hmm.
Just jumped into the Boston Marathon. She wanted to enter, but they wouldn't allow her.
Mm-hmm.
So she, of course, in your usual marathoner stubbornness, ran anyway, and ran quite well. She ran about 3:20. She was quite a good athlete.
Now, in 1967, though, there was a woman the next year, there was a woman who ran actually with a number on, and that turned into quite a melodramatic moment in the race.
Yeah. Catherine Switzer entered as Kay Switzer, got a number, and the race officials wanted to take the number back, and they tried to take it off her while she was running the race. And she's running with her boyfriend, who's a hammer thrower.
Mm-hmm.
So he body blocked the race director, Jock Semple, out of the way, and pushed him off the way, and that, of course, the photographer captured an image of that, and that's gone down to show that, you know, show the hide-bound Boston Marathon didn't want to allow women. Well, you know, they considered the rules only allowed men, and she was violating the rules. It took until 72 for the Boston Marathon to come around.
Interesting.
And realized that women, you know, were serious about the marathon and weren't just doing it to make a political statement or just to attract attention. They were really competitors, and they were really showing up at other races.
We're talking about the history of the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Will from Conway, welcome to The Exchange.
Thank you, Tom. I've read your book. I really enjoyed it. You may mentioned... one that there's only been one winner from New Hampshire. I thought Clarence DeMar, who won, I think, 5 times, was from Keene. There is a marathon dedicated to him run every year in Keene, New Hampshire. Go ahead.
Well, he lived in Keene. He lived in Melrose, Mass., and he was born in Massachusetts.
Okay. Will, you
so
have
you
a second question?
You could say he was sometimes from Keene.
Okay. Will?
And I've run the marathon 4 times, and I really feel for the runners today, because if you train up in northern New Hampshire, and it's been a cold winter this year for training, and it's going to be a shock to their systems. But I know the emergency medical services there are great, but the best thing will be the runners making those decisions on their own and not getting too far ahead of themselves, because once you start getting into heat stroke, you don't think correctly. Tom, keep up the good work, and I enjoy your show. Thank you.
All right, well, thanks for that phone call. Tom, now, just how bad can hot weather be for people running in the Boston Marathon?
Oh, well, I think at Boston, at least from my experience in 76, when it was the temperatures were up to in the mid-90s, sometimes some places recorded over 100, there were people everywhere with water. So you could take water just whenever you wanted, drink it, you could dump it on your head. So running, you could almost create your own rainstorm by dumping water on your head. So at Boston, the spectators, the officials want to do everything possible to help the runners and provide them with water. So it's not like running across the desert. You're not on your own. You have plenty of help. So there's really no reason why a fit, well-trained person cannot run fairly well, even when it's hot at Boston, because they're so well provided for. Yeah, the hot weather will slow one down. A person is certainly best off in some temperature that's like what they've been training in. So ideally would be 50 degrees and a huge tailwind, I suppose.
Now, is it possible for somebody to drink too much water when they're running in a marathon?
That's has happened to some people, and what happens is they take in so much water that the sodium balance in their body is upset. That there's just too much water in the body. They're unable now to process all the chemical signals that make the heart beat, and they die. However, that takes a not very well trained person, and it takes 6 hours or so to do that. 5 hours. Most marathoners are finished by then,
mm-hmm.
and one has to really be extreme in ingesting water to do that. Most of the problems are dehydration.
Now, we've talked about the dangers of running. Have there been deaths in the Boston Marathon?
There have been deaths in marathons in Boston. I can't recall exactly who and when. But you have 20,000 people doing something, and out of a population of 20,000, some people have unknown heart problems, and it strikes them under that stress.
So there still is a bit of a fear of death as people run in the Boston Marathon. Then
there is. It's not any more likely in the marathon than it is any other time. I mean, some people have. Well, one of the most frequent symptoms of a heart condition, I'm told, is sudden death. So a lot of people just don't know they have heart conditions, and they will suddenly die. And sometimes it's during a marathon, and most of the time it's some other time.
We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation. Do you have interesting stories from the Boston Marathon? Maybe you ran it one time. You can call and join the show. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Tom Derderian is here to talk to you about the Boston Marathon. You can join the conversation here on New Hampshire Public Radio.
More of our discussion of the Boston Marathon on The Exchange coming up on the stations of New Hampshire Public Radio. We get support from the New Hampshire Association of the Blind, hosting the Blind Awareness Walk May 21st at the McGreal Sight Center in Concord. Details online at sightcenter.com. From the law firm of Upton and Hatfield, with offices in Concord, Hillsborough, and North Conway, serving New Hampshire municipalities, businesses, and individuals since 1908. And the Courier Museum of Art, presenting the exhibition African American Masters, Highlights in the Smithsonian American Art Museum, now through June 7th. Information at courier.org. NHPR News and Information for the Granite State. It's 9:30.
This is The Exchange on New Hampshire Public Radio. I'm Mike Arnold in for Laura Kanoy. Tomorrow on the program, At-Risk Youth, on the fifth anniversary of the shootings at Columbine. We'll take a look at what's being done to children who feel disconnected and are in danger of engaging in risky behavior. That's tomorrow on The Exchange, but right now we're talking about the Boston Marathon with Tom Derderian, a 14-time Boston Marathon finisher with a best time of 2:19, a coach for the Greater Boston Track Club and author of two books on the Boston Marathon. And if you have any stories from the marathon or have ever run it, you can call and join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Now, Tom, there are a lot of interesting characters who have been associated with the Boston Marathon over the years. Who would you say is probably one of the more interesting people that you discovered as you looked into the history of the Boston Marathon?
Well, I mentioned the first woman, Roberta Gibb. I guess she has to be remarkable in that she was the one with the courage to break the mold. She was a good athlete, but she also came to the marathon obliquely. Her field was art. She's makes beautiful sculptures. She was a painter. She lives in Rockport, Massachusetts. She came to the marathon as an art form, a thing of beauty. She didn't come as a person who had been running track and field and cross-country races. She didn't do much of that. She came as a celebration of physical ability. So it was a different attitude. She brought something to the marathon that hadn't been there before, this celebration of physicality, an aesthetic to the race. So she was quite remarkable and a very good athlete, and probably would have been able to run with the top women of these days had she trained as a serious competitor.
Another interesting character that you've written about is Tarzan Brown. Could you tell us more about him?
Yeah, there's the myth about Tarzan Brown. There's always these myths around because people like to believe them. The myth of Tarzan Brown, who was a Narragansett Indian from Rhode Island, was that one year in the marathon, he decided it was too hot and jumped in Lake Kitchituit for a swim and stayed there. Well, I looked at all the records, and everyone would say, Tarzan Brown. There was that year that Tarzan Brown jumped in the lake and stayed there. Well, I never found any reference that said this year he jumped in the lake. But it was a Tarzan Brown kind of thing to do.
Mm-hmm.
He would zoom out to early leads and as marathoners say, crash and burn, and finish way back.
Mm-hmm.
1 year, 39, he just took off and kept going. Old Kelly caught him at one point, said some words to him, thinking that Tarzan Brown was going to slow down again.
Mm-hmm.
But he didn't. He just took off and won in 1939 by a considerable margin. He was a fantastic athlete. He went to the Olympics in Berlin in 1936, and you know, since he was, you know, dark-skinned American Indian, was in a bar and was being made fun of by some Hitler youth, and he got in a fight. So we can say that Tarzan Brown was the first American to fight the Nazis.
Wow. Interesting. And you mentioned Johnny Kelly, too. He was another popular name in the marathon history as well.
So he won in 1935. And kept trying to win and finishing second and third and so on until 1945 when he won again. So quite remarkable that his victories were 10 years apart. And then he continued to run year after year after year and ran some record number of 60 Boston Marathons.
We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. The number 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Have you ever run the Boston Marathon? Colin, tell us about your experience with that. Do you have a favorite Boston Marathon moment? Call and let us know. Why is it that the Boston Marathon has an appeal that supersedes all other marathon events? We'd like to hear that. Also, have you ever watched the Boston Marathon firsthand? Do you have stories from there or memories of certain parts of the race that are interesting? Call in and join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Mark from Keene, welcome to The Exchange.
How are you doing?
Okay.
I was going to say, hey, Tom, another colorful character, was her name Rosie, who snuck into the race a couple years back?
Yeah, I don't like to talk about her. You know, sometimes when people know only one name from the Boston Marathon, I would like it to be Clarence DeMar, who won seven times,
yeah,
or Johnny Kelly, and
yeah,
not the cheat.
I was going to say, it won't happen this year because I'm on my way to Boston right now, and I'm a volunteer. There's going to be 100 of us along the path, sponsored by Hewlett-Packard, and we're all going to have a compact computer, and we're going to track all the racers for the whole distance.
Really?
Yep. So
how do you do that?
They've got a program. All of the runners are being given like a little computer chip, and we're going to track them the whole distance. And the program that they've given us, we just plug it into the little iPack, and I can tell you where the runner is on the course and what his time is.
Now, Mark, how did you get involved in this?
I met a girl in Manchester who's the promotional sponsor for this, and she does this for Hewlett-Packard. Her name is Karen Bouvier, and she's the one who set the whole thing up. And so if you are watching television, we'll all have the Cat in the Hat, you know, the red and white one?
Mm-hmm.
We're going to have one that's blue and white that'll look the same. You'll see about 100 of us along the trail.
Now, are you a marathon runner, Mark?
Nope. The most I've done is a 10K.
Really? Now, have you been to the Boston Marathon before?
Never.
So this is the first time for you?
First time, and I'm very excited.
Well, thanks for that phone call, Mark. Tom, it looks like they've moved to quite high-tech tactics to chase the runners this time around.
It is quite cool. There are little computer chips attached to each runner that will detect a signal from mats along the route at each of the checkpoints at 5K, 10K, and so on, as well as the start and the finish. And these chips will send a message to a central computer. So the cool thing for me, since I'm coaching 28 people in the race, I'll sit in the press room and I'll be able to type Greater Boston Track Club into the computer, men's open team, women's open team, and get the times of these runners as they pass 5K, all printed out. I think that's the neatest thing, to be able to do that.
One of the reasons this has been designed was because of the person you didn't want to talk about, right? There was at least one time where somebody sort of jumped into the race midstream, and it appeared that she actually won when she didn't.
Well, this actually happened more than one time.
Oh, really?
There have been lots of cheats in the marathon.
Huh.
And there was a cheat in 1909. This guy named Pierce jumped in, and he wouldn't jump out.
Huh.
He'd been in the race, took a ride because it was so hot, and then jumped out of the car and started running. And finally, the police had to grab him and pull him out of the race physically.
Wow.
So I suppose if someone is jumping into the race and cheating, maybe the police would have to pull them out, particularly if they're in first place and prominent. But on many occasions, there have been cheats jumping into the race. There have been fraternity boys who, as a prank, would jump into the race in the last 100 yards and sprint ahead of the winner.
Hmm.
People use such a prominent event to do these, stupid things.
Right, right. Well, it looks like they're moving in a direction to stop that from happening in the future. We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation. The number is 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Hoyt from Merrimack, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi, this is a fun show. I'm afraid this is the first time in about 20 years that I'm not there to watch the race. I have to work today. Too bad. But I wanted to mention kind of a story I enjoy telling is the fact that I'll never qualify for Boston, but I ran it twice, the first time in three legs, going from the start to Wellesley, then Wellesley to the top of Heartbreak Hill, and then the finish the third year. And then the next time I did it in two legs, Wellesley as the midpoint. So I took a full year off my time. I was very proud. And among the things that I marveled at as I ran was seeing Johnny Kelly, which was a real privilege. And I don't know that you've brought up the amazing duo of Dick and Rick Hoyt. Have you talked about that already?
No, we haven't.
Well, I'm sure that your guest can tell you all about them, but they're a father and son. The son was born with severe disabilities, and the father and the son refused to let those interfere with his life. So they run the marathon every year. They're running today. I just checked the website, which is teamhoyt.com, and the father pushes the son in a special chair, and they've actually done the Ironman competition, which is just phenomenal, where Dick Hoyt pulls his son in a boat during the swimming phase. So they're quite the amazing pair, and a real tribute to what can be done if you decide not to let your disabilities disable you.
Now, Hoyt, you mentioned that this is the first time you haven't been to the Boston Marathon in a long time. Is there a particular part of the marathon that you like to watch it or participate?
Well, I mostly go to get inspired. I lived in Brookline, Mass., so I was very near the Cleveland Circle Turn, which is about mile 21 or so, 22 maybe. So I would go there. Lately, last few years, I've lived in New Hampshire for about 10 years. I would go down to the overpass over 128 near, I forget what the town is, some town in Newton, and watch the people go by. One of the things that I find really cool about the marathon is that you see all kinds and shapes. The archetypal runner is 5'8", 145 pounds, but there are, heavy people, really tall people, little stubby people, look like refugees from the Wizard of Oz and Munchkin Land, and they're all athletes, and they're all doing this amazing thing, so it's impossible for me to watch and not have my spirit of running renewed.
Well, Hoyt, thanks for that phone call. Tom, way to watch the runners and be inspired by them. One of them mentioned by Hoyt was Dick and Rick Hoyt, who actually are running this year.
Yeah, they've been running for a long time, since, maybe always sometime in the 80s, and they seem to enjoy it. I see them around a lot, and they enjoy the process. And Dick Hoyt even had a heart attack about a year ago, has survived that and is back in training and has his heart medication and is doing very well.
So now, is one of the things that Hoyt mentioned, the fact that there are all different kinds of people running in this race, is that part of what makes the Boston Marathon interesting to you?
Well, I think attracts people to the marathon is that at first it seems like an enormously difficult thing to do, to run 26 miles. However, human beings are endurance athletes or have the potential, the genetic potential, all humans, to respond to training. I mean, that's the kind of animals we are. When we are not training, our bodies don't produce all the things in themselves that would allow for running for a long time without getting tired. When we start to train, the body adapts. I mean, that's the way our ancestors, throughout the evolution of humans, were able to survive. I mean, sometimes there were famines, sometimes migrations were necessary. So the human body adapts marvelously to long-distance running. That is all human bodies. There isn't anyone who doesn't adapt. I mean, that's part of being human.
We're talking about
some adapt faster than others.
Right. We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation at 1-800-892-6477. If you have memories or stories from the Boston Marathon or questions about it, you can call now at 1-800-892-NHPR. Tom Derderian is here with us. He has written two books about the Boston Marathon. He's a coach for the Greater Boston Track Club, and he also is a 14-time Boston Marathon finisher with a best time of 2 hours, 19 minutes. Let's go to the phones. Ken from St. Paul's School in Concord, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. I had a question for Mr. Dejarian about his opinion of runners in, who have entered the Boston Marathon who haven't qualified, but they're running for a different cause, raising money for cancer research or something. And it was discussed on NPR the other day, and the editor of Running Times seemed very against runners who haven't qualified entering the race. And I was wondering what your opinion is of this.
Ken, thanks for that call. Tom, you have any response to that?
Yeah, sometimes people get upset with me when I answer that question. They think that I am for the diseases when I think that the money can be raised other ways than through road races. The Boston Marathon has struck a good balance in limiting the number of people who can enter the race raising money for charities to some fairly small percentage. So it has not changed the purpose of the race. What I really object to is races that have their reason for being to be fundraisers rather than races that are races primarily. You know, I argue that the racing itself is a public health benefit. Having lots of people compete in races and train for races does a great deal to improve public health, and that money should be raised to fight diseases through taxes. That's much more efficient than having every disease compete with every other disease by trying to be more attractive. I mean, do you give money to the Liver Foundation or kidneys or, you know, whichever organ? You know, there needs to be a central group of people who raise the money through taxes and then fight the diseases as a matter of public health, like we do providing clean water and sewerage. So that's the difference. I think running itself is the charity, and to promote good health in people, we need to provide more safe places for people to run. You know, I would put running trails around every golf course, around every cemetery, around every school, light those paths so people can run at night, particularly, you know, in the Northeast where it's dark most of the winter. So that's my argument on that. And some people get upset with me that I'm for disease, and that's certainly not the case, that running is the charity I'm in favor of.
We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. You can join the conversation. Have you ever run the Boston Marathon? You can talk about your experience, or what was your favorite Boston Marathon moment or favorite runner? Call now, 1-800-892-6477. That's 1-800-892-NHPR. Mary Ann from Concord, welcome to The Exchange.
Hi. I ran with the Greater Boston Track Club in the 80s and early 90s when the women's coach was Ralph and Bill, and ran the marathon myself four times. And I just remember the last time I ran was the 100th Boston Marathon, which in and of itself was an amazing event. But the coach of the women's team at the time, I remember him saying to me, he didn't recommend the marathon in general for most people because of what the long-term wear that it did to your body. And two questions ago, you answered that you thought people can adapt. But do you think that it is, you know, damaging at some points for people to just go out and pound the pavement that much?
Mary Ann, thanks for that phone call. Tom, any thoughts on that?
Yeah, I think the longer you train and the harder you train, eventually something goes wrong. Eventually there will be some sort of problem here, there, or somewhere else. And if you keep pushing the training and keep ratcheting the training up and up and up, something will break. Eventually, one can train for a marathon as one ages, decrease the training, settle for slower times, and continue for quite a long time. Some people encounter difficulties when they just can't train the way they used to train and race the way they used to train, and encounter problems. But the body is remarkably resilient. So it repairs itself. The analogy is not like a machine that wears out. I mean, we're not like our cars that just get worse and worse and worse, and then we throw them away. A person who's been running for many years may have knees that are just perfectly fine. They slow down for other reasons. The parts don't wear out. And humans are remarkable that way.
We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. Barbara from Plymouth, welcome to The Exchange. Barbara?
Hi. Yes, sorry. Yes. My son and I are headed down to watch the marathon. We go every year. And I just wanted to call. One thing that I really like about the marathon is I've run it several times, twice for the team in training. There's very few sports or events where an average athlete can compete against the elite in the sport. So, I mean, not that I have any chance of winning, but I am certainly running against the winners, the best in the world. And I go in, I watch them warm up ahead of time. And it's just a special thing. The whole route is special. People cheer. For me, I finish in 4.5 hours, the same as they cheer for the winners, or at least that's what it feels like. So we're enjoying your show. Thanks for having this topic. And that's all.
All right. Thanks for your call, Barbara. Tom, is that one of the appeals for runners in the Boston Marathon, is the chance to run with these great runners?
Certainly. I mean, you can't do that in other sports. You can't just jump on the field at the Super Bowl, catch
right.
a pass, and run away with it. But in the Boston Marathon and in road races in general, everyone is competing over the same distance. Yes, in human beings, the abilities are remarkably different. A professional, well-trained, genetically gifted runner can run a marathon more than twice as fast as others. However, the challenge is the same. I mean, you're competing against the distance. It's the same. It's hard, and it's a race. And it's a race from, first to second, second to third, 100th to 101st. And there's a race between 1,300th place and so on, all the way to the very, very slowest runners. So, it's very much a competition, and that's the challenge.
We're talking about the Boston Marathon today on The Exchange. John from Guilford, welcome to the program.
Hi, how are you?
Okay.
Good. It's a funny story. It's sort of the antithesis of a soccer mom, I guess. My wife and I used to go up to an island in Maine and for a few weeks during the summer. And it was the island where Joan Benoit and her family had a summer home and where she used to run all the time. It was a small island. But this was a few months before the Los Angeles Olympics, and she was there training. And I remember my wife, who used to jog, if on a good day she could do 2 miles in about an hour. And so she was slogging up this island road, and her friend was sitting there talking to Joan's mother. And she stopped, and her friend introduced her to Joan's mother, and her mother looked at her, at Linda, my wife, and she said, "You know, my daughter does that thing." And Linda said, "What thing?" She said, "That jogging thing." She said, "Here's what I want you to do. I'll have her call you tomorrow, and you can do that thing together." It was so laid back, and I don't think she had any clue that her daughter was about to go to the Los Angeles Olympics and win it.
Did your wife run with her?
No, she did not. I mean, just a couple of years ago, my wife died, and she was buried on the island, and I was sitting there about 5 o'clock in the morning outside, and I heard this whoosh, and it was Joan just running right by, just as fast as ever.
Well, John, thanks for that phone call. Joan Benoit is definitely somebody who is famous in marathon lore, correct, Tom?
Oh, certainly. She had set the course record at Boston and won the first ever women's Olympic marathon in 84 in Los Angeles. And that's a bit of history that will be forever. There'll only be one first. I mean, there'll be other women running faster and winning gold medals, but there's only one first woman. I mean, the Olympics started in 1896, and it took until 1994 for a women's marathon to be accepted.
Well, let's take one.
So
last
Joan was a pioneer on that. Yeah.
That's great. Yeah. Well, let's take one last phone call before we wrap things up today. Greg from Londonderry, welcome to The Exchange.
Oh, thank you. I just want to say real quickly, I've run the marathon twice, so once 20 years ago and once 2 years ago, and it was the longest race and the shortest race I ever ran. 20 years ago when I ran it in 2.5 hours, I didn't think it would ever be over. And when I ran 2 years ago as a disabled athlete in just under 5 hours, It was the greatest experience in the world. You know, people now, with there's so many people along the route, you know, and people put their name down the side of their leg in magic marker on their arm, and people scream and yell for you for all 26 miles. It's the greatest experience you can ever have.
Well, Greg, thanks for that phone call. The fans are really an important part of the Boston Marathon, aren't they, Tom?
Well, one year I was running the marathon, and I was having a bad race, and I didn't want to run anymore. I wanted to drop out. I kept trying to drop out, and the people kept pushing me back onto the course. You can do it. You can do it. They wouldn't let me drop out. I was forced by the spectators to keep going. So I finally finished, sort of reluctantly. They made me do it. So the fans are an active part of the race. They're not just passive. They're part of it. They are the race.
Well, Tom Tredurian, thank you so much for your time today.
You're welcome.
It's a 14-time Boston Marathon finisher with a best time of 2:19, a coach for the Greater Boston Track Club, and author of two books on the Boston Marathon. Tom Tredurian, thanks for joining us on The Exchange. Tomorrow on The Exchange, we'll talk about at-risk youth. For a list of upcoming shows on The Exchange, you can visit The Exchange page at nhpr.org. You can also sign up to get a calendar of what's ahead. That's at www.nhpr.org. The Exchange is a production of NHPR, produced by Keith Shields, Rebecca Kaufman, and Ty Fraley. I'm Mike Arnold. Talk to you tomorrow.